despite officials declaring in the most secure election in American history. The entire election, frankly, in all the swing states should be overturned, and the legislatures should make sure that the electors are selected for Donald Trump, Sidney Powell, one of Trump's lawyers, told the Fox Business Network on Thursday. Michigan state legislative leaders, the Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey and the House Speaker Lee Chatfield, both Republicans, visited the White House on Friday at Donald Trump's request. Mike Shirkey was greeted by protesters and media at Washington's Reagan International Airport. There were chants of "Certify the results" and a shout of "Where is the evidence of fraud?" However, following the White House meeting, Mike Shirkey and Lee Chatfield affirmed their commitment to abide by the electoral process in an apparent blow to Donald Trump's efforts. "We have not yet been made aware of any information that would change the outcome of the election in Michigan, and as legislative leaders, we will follow the law and follow the normal process regarding Michigan's electors," the pair said in a joint statement. Michigan's certification process should be a deliberate process free from threats and intimidation. Most experts have dismissed Donald Trump's efforts as political fantasy and probably unlawful. But they warn that an American president trying to reverse a free and fair election could poison millions of minds, conditioning his base to lose faith in democracy and regard Joe Biden as an illegitimate president. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton, a former Secretary of State defeated by Donald Trump in the 2016 election, tweeted on Friday, "Protecting one man's ego is not worth damaging the legitimacy of our democracy." Joe Biden, a former vice president, won the election and is preparing to take office on 20th of January. But Donald Trump has refused to concede and is searching for a way to invalidate the results, alleging widespread irregularities without providing any evidence. Speaking in the White House briefing room on Friday about an initiative to lower prescription medicine prices, Donald Trump maintained his baseless claim that he was the true winner of the election. "Big Pharma ran millions of dollars of negative advertisements against me during the campaign, which I won, by the way," he told reporters. "But you know, we'll find that out. Almost 74 million votes. We had Big Pharma against us. We had the media against us. We had big technology against us. We had a lot of dishonesty against us." Joe Biden received nearly 6 million more votes than Donald Trump. But the winner is determined by the Electoral College, where each state's electoral votes, based largely on population, are awarded to the winner of a state's popular vote. Joe Biden leads by 306 electoral votes to Donald Trump's 232. As states work to certify their results at least 6 days before the Electoral College convenes on 14th of December to ratify the vote. The Trump campaign is particularly targeting Michigan, which Joe Biden won by 154,000 votes in the hope that Republicans there will manipulate the electoral system. Both Shirkey and Chatfield have previously denied that they might try to overturn Joe Biden's win, noting that Michigan law does not allow the legislature to directly select electors or award them to anyone other than the person who received the most votes. Even so, Michigan's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, told MSNBC television network, "It's incredibly dangerous that they're even entertaining the conversation. This is an embarrassment for the state of Michigan." Earlier this week, two Republican canvassers blocked the certification of votes in Wayne County, Michigan, where Detroit is located, a major black city. They later relented amid cries of racism and the results were certified. It then emerged that President Donald Trump made contact with the canvassers, Monica Palmer and William Hartman, on Tuesday to express his gratitude for their support. On Wednesday, Monica Palmer and William Hartman signed affidavits saying they believed the county vote should not be certified after all. But Michigan's Secretary of State said they cannot rescind their votes. Donald Trump's dominance of the Republican Party is such that few prominent Republicans have spoken out against his scorched earth policy. However, Mitt Romney, a senator, a Republican senator from Utah, and the party's 2012 presidential nominee, broke ranks on Thursday. Mitt Romney said, "Having failed to make even a plausible case of widespread fraud or conspiracy before any court of law, the president has now resorted to overt pressure on state and local officials to subvert the will of the people and overturn the result of the election. It is difficult to imagine a worse, more undemocratic action by a sitting American president." Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, a Republican and Donald Trump supporter, on Friday certified the results that showed Joe Biden won the state by just over 12,600 votes after a manual recount and an audit were conducted. "The numbers reflect the verdict of the people, not a decision by the Secretary of State's office or courts of law or of either campaigns," he told reporters. Donald Trump's attempts to reverse his defeat via lawsuits and recounts have met with no meaningful success, yet his campaign has not abandoned its offensive in the courts of law. Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, said in an hour-and-a-half-long press conference on Thursday that there are plans to file more lawsuits. Giuliani accused Democrats of masterminding a national conspiracy to steal the election, referencing China, Cuba, the Clinton Foundation, and billionaire George Soros, and the late Venezuelan president Hugo Chavez, but offering no proof whatsoever. "I know crimes and I can smell them," said Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, sweating profusely. "You don't have to smell this one, I can prove it to you." He offered no evidence to support his claims. Chris Krebs, the Trump administration election official fired last week by Donald Trump over the comments about the security of the election, tweeted, "That press conference was the most dangerous 1 hour 45 minutes of television in American history, and possibly the craziest. Joe Biden, celebrating his 78th birthday, he is the oldest U.S. president-elect in history, met the House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on Friday after spending most of the week with advisors planning his administration, despite the refusal of the Trump administration to cooperate with his team, even over dealings with the coronavirus pandemic.
On August 6, 1945, some eyewitnesses were cited as saying that they had seen another sun rising in Japanese sky. There was no second sun. It was the U.S. first nuclear bomb, codenamed Little Boy, that was exploded at an altitude of 576 meters above the ground over the city of Hiroshima. 3 days later, the U.S. second nuclear bomb, nicknamed Fat Man, was dropped on the people of the city of Nagasaki to once again show off America's nuclear capability to the world and its east rival. However, the U.S. Army's show of power in the last days of the Second World War resulted in the killing of 220,000 Japanese civilians. The energy emitted from the explosion of Little Boy was estimated to equal a blast caused by 16,000 tons of TNT. A horrific bomb that the Americans managed to build only because they had got access to large uranium deposits. The country through which the required uranium to build these two bombs was provided lied in the heart of the African continent and was known as the Belgian Congo. June 30, 1960, the people of the Congo officially celebrated independence from Belgian colonialism. High-ranking officials from the Congo and other African countries attended the official independence ceremony. The event had a special guest. The Belgian king came to the Congo to give the gift of independence to the people of the country. Ceremony, the king hailed the unwavering and wise sacrifices made by Belgium's former king and the founder of the Congo's colonialism, Leopold II, and lauded his efforts to civilize and liberate the people of the Congo from the yoke of colonialism. After the Belgian king's speech, Congolese president Joseph Kasavubu took the podium. But the story did not end there. Although the Prime Minister's speech was not on the agenda, Patrice Lumumba took the podium after President Kasavubu. The participants' stunned look at the Prime Minister had only one meaning. Patrice Lumumba was a dead Prime Minister now. The Congo is so rich in natural resources and vast deposits of mineral that it can be called a treasure island in the heart of Africa. Rivers, dense rainforests, diverse animal species, and unique underground resources, including copper, gold, uranium, coltan, and diamond, and in most cases there is no other known example in our world to rival them. Despite its huge natural wealth, the Congo is among the world's poorest nations. This contradiction is rooted in successive calamities aimed at looting the Congo's natural treasures throughout history, which were endured by the people of this country. The crisis broke out when a white European decided to civilize the people of the Congo. In the late 19th century, Belgian King Leopold II sought to keep up with European neighbors. He had to find a colony to remain in the race. Most of the world's regions that were rich in resources had been already seized by competitors at the time. Africa was the only viable option. Sponsored by Sir Henry Morton Stanley, one of his friends, Leopold tried to find a suitable land as his colony. As an explorer in the heart of Africa, Stanley traveled along the Congo River and purchased land for the Belgian king after negotiating with African tribal chiefs. He bought the lands at a very low price, for example, in exchange for some clothes. So, in the early 1880s, Leopold could turn a land spanning as much as 900,000 square miles, that is 87 times the size of Belgium, into personal property. In 1884, the U.S. became the first country to recognize Leopold's sovereignty over the Congo. Leopold took advantage of this opportunity and officially claimed Belgium's sovereignty over the Congo. The shadows of Belgium's colonialism continued to affect the people of the Congo 8 years later and even after Leopold's death. The Congo's indigenous people were exploited as slaves in the country's mines, where they extracted their country's natural resources for the Belgians. The indigenous workers' wives and children were taken hostage to be subjected to harassment and even sexual abuse if the indigenous man refused to work, and they were sometimes murdered. At that time, one of the most common punishments for disobedience was to cut off the two hands. Although the Belgian government made extensive efforts to conceal its crimes in the Congo and even destroyed certain documents and reports, the articles that were published years later by Western journalists about that era revealed that as many as half of the Congo's population had been killed during Leopold's 40-year rule, which amounts to a massacre of tens of millions of people. The days of independence dawned after years of fighting by the people of the Congo. During the battle, the voice that was more vociferous than those of others belonged to a good-looking, determined young man named Patrice Lumumba. He wanted to obliterate the legacy of Leopold, which continued to haunt his country. Lumumba was imprisoned for his anti-colonialism activities for a while, but he was elected as leader of the Congolese National Movement in 1958. A movement led by the young Lumumba, which managed to overcome ethnic and tribal differences and revive the spirit of national unity and independence seeking among millions of the Congolese people. Heading a delegation, Lumumba went to Brussels and took part in Congolese independence talks. The negotiations resulted in holding the first free elections in the country. The result of the election stunned many, including Belgian colonialists. The MNC party won the election and Patrice Lumumba became the prime minister. Lumumba's government took office on June the 24th, 1960. He invited all people, even white Belgians, to unity to build a Congo. However, his Independence Day speech worried all those who had a vested interest in the Congo. The Prime Minister did not have to deal with the Belgians only because other powers like the UK and the US had gotten involved in the Congo as well. Lumumba's remaining in power as Prime Minister could pose a big challenge to those countries' growing interests. In August, the CIA station in the Congo sent a telegram to Washington that stated, quote, "Embassy and station believe the Congo experiencing classic communist effort to take over government," unquote. The message was addressed to CIA Director Alan Dulles, who had already managed to overthrow popular governments, including the one led by Mossadegh in Iran and Arbenz's government in Guatemala. Dulles warned the U.S. government against catastrophic consequences of communists' encroachment in the Congo, which could likely pose a threat to the free world's interests. On August 18, 1960, President Eisenhower told Dulles that the U.S. needed to do everything it could to remove Lumumba from power. Dulles sent a cable to Lawrence Devlin, the CIA's Congo station chief, ordering him to take more aggressive yet clandestine measures to that goal. The first coup plot in the Congo was hatched with the help of the U.S. Western allies. The state of Katanga was a rich mining region in the Congo which had large deposits of copper, cobalt, uranium, and gold. Moise Tshombe, an old friend of Western multinational corporations, was the president of the state. Katanga proclaimed its independence and secession from the Congo only 11 days after the country's independence and staged rebellion against the central government and Prime Minister Lumumba himself. It is worth mentioning that as much as Moise Tshombe was pro-Western, he had a strange grudge against Lumumba. As the first step, Belgium immediately backed Katanga's independence proclamation. The situation was worsening, and Patrice Lumumba needed extra help to deal with Katanga's separatist forces. Lumumba knew well that his Western enemies accuse him of supporting the Eastern Bloc. However, he did not ask for the Soviets' help, although they were famous for supporting anti-West reformist movements. He instead sought the U.S. help. But under the pretext of avoiding a conflict with the Soviets, the U.S. ambassador proposed that the Congo should ask for help from the U.N. Therefore, upon a request from Lumumba's government, U.N. Blue Helmets arrived in Leopoldville and were deployed to some regions, including Katanga. But these forces failed to carry out an effective measure to counter Katanga's separatists. To get more help to counter rebel forces as well as Belgium's military interventions, the Prime Minister headed to the White House without an official invitation. Against all his expectations, the U.S. did not welcome him. Certain American newspapers called him the dictator of the forest, and American officials refused to provide any sort of assistance to the Congo's democratically elected Prime Minister to resolve the country's problems. 15 years later, the U.S. Senate launched extensive investigations into interference of the CIA and the U.S. government in the Congo. The probe was led by Senator Frank Church. According to the reports of the Church Committee, the then U.S. president had issued a direct order to the CIA to assassinate Lumumba, and the CIA had launched a plot to eliminate the Congo's prime minister. To achieve this goal, two projects were put on the agenda. One of the projects was proposed by Joseph Schneider, a CIA scientific assistant. According to Schneider's project, a lethal virus indigenous to the Congo had to be administered to Lumumba in any possible way. In the second project, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb injected a lethal poison into toothpaste that was sent for Lumumba in a diplomatic package. But memoirs of the CIA station in the Congo said American spies in the Congo failed to carry out the operation. As the toothpaste passed its expiration date and was in fact useless, the evidence of crime was dumped in the Congo River. After Lumumba was disappointed about receiving any aid from the U.S., he had no choice but to appeal to the East superpower. Unlike the U.S., the Soviets welcomed the Congo government this time. Lumumba's government needed air transport to dispatch its forces to the state of Katanga. the Soviets provided the Congo government with their aircraft to transfer forces. Relative peace was restored to Katanga. However, the Soviets' assistance provided the best excuse for the U.S. to launch more covert propaganda against Lumumba.
At his news conference, President Eisenhower faces squarely the Congo crisis, which he feels is aggravated by the Soviet Union's intervention by sending planes, technicians, and arms.
The United States deplores the unilateral action of the Soviet Union in supplying aircraft and other equipment for military purposes to the Congo, thereby aggravating an already serious situation which finds Africans killing other Africans.
Now they could pin the label of communist on Lumumba and his government. The Americans used this weapon in the best possible way. At the same time, CIA agents transferred new eavesdropping devices to control and anticipate Lumumba's next moves and carried them to the Prime Minister's office through their Belgian friends. All the Prime Minister's contacts and communications came under the CIA surveillance. As the Congo was engulfed in chaos, Congolese President Joseph Kasavubu removed Lumumba from power in a dismissal order on September the 5th, just 74 days after the central government had taken office, a decision that the Prime Minister refused to accept. Lumumba went to the parliament and tried to dismiss President Kasavubu. He delivered such a fervent and reasonable speech that both the Senate and the National Assembly voted in favor of Lumumba. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister needed to win the global public opinion, so he held a news conference with international journalists to inform the world of his stances. But some of these newspapers described him as Africa's Lenin. The Americans did not stand idle either. Since 1959, they had established a solid and reliable relation with a Congolese army officer called General Joseph Mobutu. Mobutu, who served as chief of staff of the army during the 1960 crisis, had been in constant contact with the CIA station chief in the Congo, Lawrence Devlin, all throughout the crisis. Relations between Mobutu and the CIA worked out well for them. Eventually, and just after 2 months, Joseph Mobutu staged a coup against Lumumba on September 14, 1960, and ousted his government, which was the first democratically elected one in the Congo's history. Meanwhile, the U.S. refused to issue a visa for Lumumba to attend the U.N. session to prevent him from addressing the world directly. Now, the Congo had two governments which both sought recognition from the U.N. Surprisingly enough, Sweden's Dag Hammarskjöld, the then U.N. Secretary General, recognized the coup government of Joseph Mobutu. The Prime Minister's situation was getting worse day by day. Lumumba's house was besieged by UN forces. The UN forces did not even allow him to speak on the radio under the pretext that Lumumba's remarks would aggravate the crisis and would further increase tensions. The communication between the head of Congo's democratically elected government and the people was cut off.
Finally, Lumumba managed to escape the UN besiege and headed with his family to the city of Stanleyville, located 2,000 kilometers north of the capital, where Lumumba's supporters were seeking to form a government alongside the coup government. Patrice Lumumba delivered speeches to the people in most of the cities and villages in his escape to the north to inform them about the facts behind the developments in the Congo. CIA agents followed Lumumba all throughout the way. They were looking for a suitable place where the coup army could arrest him. On December 1, 1960, as the Prime Minister was crossing the Sankuru River with his family, the spies announced that the time was ripe for his arrest. As Lumumba's boat approached the shore, forces loyal to the coup leader Mobutu got into the boat. Lumumba was taken to the capital aboard a plane, but those who accompanied him forgot that he was the prime minister until just a few days ago. Patrice Lumumba arrived at the airport of Leopold, which was full of reporters. They showed the prime minister to the public in a very humiliating and offensive way, a move which was planned to tarnish his charismatic image. His wife and children were witnesses to what was happening at the airport some meters away. Lumumba, along with two of his cabinet ministers, Maurice Ampolo and Joseph Okito, were sent to the state of Katanga to be executed. Moise Tshombe, Lumumba's archenemy, was looking forward to receiving his guest. On June 17, 1961, the Katanga government, led by Moise Tshombe and supported by Belgian advisors, decided that Patrice Lumumba and his two accompanying ministers should be executed. At around 8:30 p.m., the prisoners were taken to a place in the depth of a remote forest to be executed. Moise Tshombe was present in the place along with his ministers. The soldiers shot Lumumba and his companions dead and then rolled their bodies into a ditch. The coup government spread a rumor in an attempt to answer to the public opinion. The rumor was that Lumumba had escaped in a stolen car and was later arrested and killed by local people. However, the people of the Congo never believed this official account of the incident. The true story about the abduction and execution of Lumumba was leaked after several years. But Lumumba's body could also be highly problematic. He was so popular that the discovery of his body could put his murderers into trouble. Therefore, they decided to exhume and destroy the bodies. The mission was delegated to a Belgian officer called Gerard Sauter. they returned to the place where the bodies had been buried. They exhumed the bodies, and after drinking a lot of alcohol, they dismembered the bodies and dissolved them in sulfuric acid. After years of conflict and civil war, Joseph Mobutu wrested full control over the Congo in 1965. After that, Mobutu, who called himself Mobutu Sese Seko, ruled over the Congo for 32 years with an iron fist. He even changed the name of the Congo to Zaire. With Mobutu's seizing of power, the U.S. had found a puppet government in the heart of the strategic continent of Africa for three decades.
Well, Zaire is among America's oldest friends, and its president, President Mobutu, one of our most valued friends. The entire continent of Africa. We are proud and very, very pleased to have you with us today. Thank you, sir.
Mobutu was one of the world's wealthiest men until 1997, with a fortune estimated as much as $5 billion, while the Congo's population of 40 million had been degraded to one of the world's poorest nations. Mobutu was ousted from power in 1997 by Laurent Kabila, a leader of one of the main rebel groups. He later died of cancer in Morocco. During the civil wars that ensued Mobutu's fall, some 5.5 million of the Congolese people were killed, while millions of others were displaced. Nine African countries and 20 militia groups were involved in the wars, which are remembered as the African World War. Civil war, violence, disease, hunger, and poverty were the legacy of the colonialist rule of Belgian King Leopold II, as well as the involvement of the White House rulers in overthrowing the only democratically elected and popular government in this green land. Although in 2002, the Belgian government apologized to the Congolese people for the involvement of its forces in deposing and killing Patrice Lumumba, the U.S. government has yet to apologize for architecting and launching the Congo coup and contributing to Patrice Lumumba's assassination.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In stacking not just his DHS team, but all of his transition teams with neoliberals and hawks, Biden has sent the world a clear signal that despite the cage-free fantasies of liberal Democrats, his immigration policy will be more of the same, says Adrian Pine, writer, in an article published under the heading, More Humane Cages? prospects for immigration justice under Biden appears dim. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Variants of the theme of caged children were used to try to shame leftists into voting for Biden in the recent presidential elections, despite the fact that, as President Trump repeatedly and correctly noted in a twisted defense of his own family separation policy, the Obama-Biden White House started the program. Instead of a reprieve from policies that fall squarely within the definition of genocide, Biden appears poised to dig in his heels. Take, for example, his appointment of Obama's former top immigration advisor, Cecilia Muñoz, to his transition team, who brushed off NPR interviewer Maria Hinojosa's question about family separation, responding that some of these things are going to happen. While much has been made of the gender diversity of Biden's transition team, including Muñoz and potential cabinet picks, it will be little comfort to the women of Central America or any other region subject to U.S. interference to know that the new U.S. girl bosses may include Susan Rice as Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton as U.N. Ambassador, or Michelle Flourney as Secretary of Defense. Many of Biden's DHS transition team selections show his platform will differ, if at all, only in form, not in substance, from that of Trump. None of his team members hail from the ranks of BIPOC organizers who delivered him his victories in key states like Arizona and for whom immigration is a major issue. Instead, Biden's picks feather the logic of his Latino campaign strategy, which pandered to right-wing Miami Cubans and Venezuelans, ignoring the vast, diverse majority of Latino communities for whom immigration, justice, access to quality health care and education, and protection from police violence are far more important than fighting communism. While numerous analysts on the left have pointed out that Biden's approach didn't even win him Florida, he's sticking to it. Biden's DHS transition team member range from billionaire-funded think tank pundits to corporate lawyers, with a smattering of left-liberal ACLU types, none of whom fundamentally question the overarching logic of border security. Take Blas Nunes Neto, for example, DHS transition team member and RAND analyst who accuses migrants of taking advantage of incentives created by the U.S. asylum process and has advocated that asylum seekers be made to seek asylum from U.S. embassies while still living in their countries, a non-starter for people fleeing deadly violence and building more private prisons to detain entire families indefinitely as humane alternatives to family separation. Beyond the more egregious stances taken by some of Biden's DHS transition committee members, they appear to be in agreement on some fundamental and fundamentally flawed points, all of which prioritize profit over human lives. For Biden's DHS team, border security, that is, preventing people without legitimate asylum claims from entering the United States, is at least as important as ensuring that the militarized security apparatus doesn't kill mostly BIPOC people on either side of the U.S. border. Privatized border security expenditures of public funds should continue at least at their current levels, shifting focus from Trump's extension of Obama-Biden's physical border walls toward ever-increasing spending on equally harmful technologies of surveillance. migration deterrence measures should follow the logic of the Biden plan for Central America, investing hundreds of millions of dollars into repressive state security apparatuses and mega development projects, despite the plan having dramatically increased impoverishment, state violence, and migration since its implementation in response to the 2014 unaccompanied minor crisis and climate change, which is dramatically increasing migration and should be taken into account in immigration policy, is not a result of capitalism and thus should not be addressed by curbing or ending it. To understand the dangers to immigrants of the likely Biden administration, it's also important to look beyond the DHS transition team to his other transition team picks. U.S. capitalist military imperialism in partnership with client governments and in regime change efforts against non-client states is the primary push factor for immigration to this country. Journalists Sarah Lazar, Alan McLeod, and Kevin Cazola have shown in recent days how Biden has already handed the reins over to the same war hawks and authors of neoliberal trade deals responsible for impoverishment, violence, and environmental devastation abroad, and consequently immigration to the United States. The defense contractors so heavily represented in Biden's transition team will profit as much from border security initiatives as they do from foreign wars. The intertwined success and violence of U.S. asylum deportation industry hinges on its profitability. In stacking not just his DHS team, but all of his transition teams with neoliberals and hawks, Biden has sent the world a clear signal that despite the cage-free fantasies of liberal Democrats, his immigration policy will be more of the same.
Bahrain's top diplomat on an official visit to Israel, breaking a long-time taboo. Foreign Minister Abdel Latif al-Zayani landed in Israel on Wednesday. His controversial trip this week marks the first such visit to Israel by any official from the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom. Al-Zayani's trip coincides with a visit to Israel by America's top diplomat Mike Pompeo. The Bahraini delegation went on to occupy Jerusalem al-Quds. The top Bahraini diplomat sat down for talks with senior Israeli officials, including his counterpart Gabi Ashkenazi and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The U.S. Secretary of State was apparently there to facilitate the controversial rapprochement. Al-Zayani's trip, which has angered the Palestinians, is part of a U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between the two sides.
It is obvious that the Trump administration wants to make sure that the normalization process and the what they used to call the deal of the century will be very crucial and strong before they get away from the power in January. So they are doing marathonian steps so that everything will be on the ground and will be very much clear laid out.
Palestinian groups denounced the trilateral meeting between the U.S., Bahrain, and Israel as a clear attack on the rights of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians want all Arab nations to refrain from establishing ties with Israel until the Israeli occupation is over and a Palestinian state becomes a reality. But as part of a U.S. brokered initiative, Bahrain and its Persian Gulf neighbor, the United Arab Emirates, signed normalization accords with Israel at the White House in mid-September. Sudan has also agreed to normalize ties with Israel as part of a deal that will guarantee much-needed U.S. financial aid. Israel has escalated its violations in the occupied territories over the past years. For instance, it has stepped up settlement construction on occupied lands. The regime has also stepped up demolition of Palestinian homes. So far this year, nearly 700 structures have been razed to the ground across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem outwards. The UN says that number is more than the figure in any full year since 2016. Palestinians have widely blamed the worsening situation on policies pursued by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. The American president makes no secret of his extremely pro-Israel stance. Trump took the American support for the regime to a whole new level by moves such as recognizing Jerusalem al-Quds as Israel's capital. Palestinian groups now say the U.S.-backed push to normalize ties between several Arab states and Israel is further emboldening the regime. How can Palestinians now trust the U.S. as it loudly brands itself as a mediator between them and Israel? Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today as several Arab states are abandoning the cause and normalizing their ties with Israel. Palestinians say these Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinians know all too well that their options are very limited at the moment. As many governments refuse to pressure the Israeli regime, the people of Palestine are hoping popular grassroots campaigns against Israel will one day change things for the better.
After months of chaos and hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, an end to the crisis triggered by the deadly coronavirus pandemic could be within reach. U.S. biotech firm Moderna has announced its experimental vaccine against COVID-19 was 94.5% effective. The announcement would make it the second major breakthrough in worldwide hunt for an effective vaccine. Moderna has announced that its newly developed vaccine would pose no significant side effects.
At the end of this trial, if the efficacy dropped down to 80% or even 70%, this is still really a very good result and a really strong reason to be optimistic to have a vaccine and very soon vaccine.
According to the data provided by the company, its vaccine was given in two doses 28 days apart, and the preliminary results are based on 95 volunteers of the 30,000 who fell ill with COVID-19. Just last week, U.S. drug maker giant Pfizer, along with its German partner BioNTech company, announced the invention of a separate effective vaccine against the deadly virus. According to scientific reports, a key advantage of Moderna's vaccine is that it does not need ultra-cold storage like Pfizer's, making it easier to distribute.
Oh, yes, certainly. I mean, these are really good results, although they are interim result, early stages data, but yet these are really exceeding the expectation, because what we expected in the scientific community and also the regulatory bodies were that we will have a coronavirus vaccine around 60 to 70% effective. And this vaccine, both of the vaccine, Moderna and Pfizer results are more than 90%.
The vaccines are viewed powerful tools to fight a pandemic that has infected 54 million people worldwide and killed 1.3 million. The news also comes at a time when COVID-19 cases are soaring, hitting new records in the United States and pushing some European countries back into lockdowns. Next year, the U.S. government could have easy access to more than 1 billion doses just from the two vaccine makers, more than needed for the country's 330 million residents. Other European nations are expected to have easy access to the vaccines. head of the World Health Organization, has hailed the rapid progress towards a COVID-19 vaccine, but insisted that every country had to reap the benefits from the vaccines. Never in history has vaccine research progressed so quickly. We must apply the same urgency and innovation to ensuring that all countries benefit from this scientific achievement.
And I can announce that we have today secured an initial agreement for 5 million doses of the Moderna vaccine.
Tedros Adhanom has said other countries could not wait for bilateral agreements to get the vaccine, since the process could take years to negotiate. There are now concerns that richer countries could monopolize the distribution of the vaccine. Western nations have already ordered millions of the doses of the vaccine, potentially leaving poorer countries in Africa and Asia without supply for years to come. It's feared relatively wealthy nations will likely be able to vaccinate their entire populations.
The first agreement that we reached with the US government was for an order of $100 million. So we anticipate to be able to ship up to 20 million of those 100 million before the end of the year. So we are making product, as you know, every day and stockpiling it. And assuming we get the green light from the FDA, I would say sometime in December, I'm sure General Perna from Operation Warp Speed will be ready with the trucks to load the product and to distribute it in the US via the CDC guidelines.
The EU has already ordered 200 million doses of Pfizer's vaccine, while the UK has ordered 40 million doses. People in low-income countries could be waiting until 2024. Drug-making companies could also benefit profusely from the world's deadliest pandemic in recent memory. Pfizer and BioNTech could make $13 billion from coronavirus vaccine.
A mega free trade pact came into existence a few days ago. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership has been described as the largest free trade agreement in history. 10 Southeast Asian countries, as well as China, South Korea, Japan, Australia, and New Zealand, formed a brand new trading bloc. The agreement was signed on the sidelines of the annual meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations on Sunday, after nearly a decade of negotiations. What makes the RCEP very important is its sheer size, nearly a third of global economy. The world's largest trading bloc has become a reality as the international community is grappling with the devastating economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. It is hoped that RCEP will spur economic recovery from the downturn caused by the virus. Meanwhile, the new agreement, which excludes the United States, is widely viewed as a geopolitical victory for the world's second largest economy, China. Observers believe it will boost China's influence in the region at a time when the U.S. is taking a tough line on its arch economic rival.
I can't emphasize enough how important the free trade agreement is for the reshaping of international political and economic relationships, and this will clearly strengthen China's hand in trying to keep the United States from its somewhat hostile incursions into what the Chinese government considers its territories.
The RCEP is described by some experts as a major win for multilateralism and free trade, despite America's withdrawal from many international agreements. The new free trade agreement is often compared to the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that U.S. President Donald Trump defiantly tore apart soon after he took office. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has been particularly confrontational in its economic strategy. The White House has implemented protectionist policies like no other U.S. administration. It has taken a tough line on China, blaming it for a large part of America's trade deficit. The U.S. has also engaged in trade conflicts with other major players like the European Union. But Trump's protectionist agenda is not preventing the rest of the world from pursuing free trade at different levels. The Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership is proof that the world prefers multilateralism.
That will give extraordinary support to the multilateralization of international trade in a way that perhaps is not contemplated in the concept of bipolarity or even in the